I just set the scene before we begin talking. And part of the scene is at the back of this Ernest Jones room, what better place to be, is a very small exhibition of bits and pieces from the archives to do with Ernest Jones. It's a sort of taster. And in the best spirit of parties, there are some take-home items in front of the exhibition, some bits of... There's a copy of a newspaper article and one or two off-prints. You're welcome to take copies with you. The exhibition has been put on by Ali Dillon, who works in the archives. Well, it's an immense pleasure to have Brenda. We've needed a good biography of Jones for some time. And Michael has mentioned her other work. Before that, coming down on the train, it struck me what a couple of years it's been, and actually the next few years will be, for anniversaries. I mean, last year was the 150th anniversary of Freud's birth. It was also the year when your book was published. It seemed very apt to have a biography of Jones' biographer in that year. This year happens to be the 50th anniversary of the publication of the final volume of that biography. So it's an auspicious sort of time, and there are other anniversaries coming up. Now, what they point to, I think, is that these coming years, as anniversaries and often centenaries, like the centenary of the first meeting of Freud and Jung, and indeed Jones and Jung this year, point to something about the history of psychoanalysis. This is when it was really getting going internationally. And of course, the first Congress, though it wasn't actually a Congress of the International, was in 1908, the first actual Congress in 1910, so more anniversaries coming. So it's particularly nice to have the 50th anniversary marked by a conversation about Jones. Now, Jones, I mention all this because, of course, Jones was absolutely central to that history. When he met Jung himself in 1907, he went on to meet Freud, and he was, from that point on, I think, central to what was going to emerge in the international movement of psychoanalysis. And I think that's where, for me, Brenda's biography is extremely good, because even though she has this background of W.B. Yeats and Rosalind Franklin and Nora Barnacle and D.H. Lawrence, all of whose lives touch on Jones's life, as you say in your introduction, I don't know how well they equipped you to deal with the particular task, it seems to me, that faced you with Jones, slip of the tongue, with Jones, and that is somehow managing to bring together the enigma of the man and his personal life with this amazing professional and public role. After all, he was central to psychoanalysis for over five decades. President of this society from 1913 at its inception to 1944, and president of the International for, I think, a total of 21 years. Now, I think that you have managed incredibly well to interweave the personal and the public, and that's perhaps something we can go on to talk about. But first, I'd like to know how you came to Jones in the first place. You say something about what interests you in the introduction, in him as you got going, but how did you get there?
Well, as you kindly said, so I've written lots of books, which you've kindly mentioned, and of course the first thing people want to know is, how did you choose your subject? And then they want to know, do you like him? I can deal with them both. But I chose him because, as you said, he'd entered all the books I'd written mm-hmm. one way or another. He wrote his Hamlet and Oedipus. Really, the explanation in the English language, except it was in German, that James Joyce read it and found its way to Joyce's library in Trieste. Jones knew what I wrote about Lawrence. Frieda Lawrence actually had known Jones in her earlier florid love life in Munich, and when she was in London, she burst into Jones's room one night saying, "My husband's trying to murder me." And Jones said, "Well, from the way you treat him, madam, I'm surprised he has not done so long before." I forgot the Yeats. Oh, yes, the Yeats was into Yeats was into Society of Psychical Research, which he believed in, Jones didn't, but it was all very much on the boil at the time. And so thanks to Yeats, I realized what Jones was up against with all the spiritualists and First World War stuff. And with Rosalind Franklin, again, I really kind of an NW3 story, Rosalind Franklin from a very distinguished Anglo-Jewish family, and we are celebrating the Day of Atonement, I must say, and I'm sure they are tonight, were very, very active in rescuing Jews from Germany and Austria in the 30s. And Rosalind Franklin's father, Ellis Franklin, was very, very active in getting Jews into London and settling them down, and so was Ernest Jones, and really not from too many miles apart here in, there in North London. And they both of them were passionately committed to making this happen and using their connections with the Home Office in one thing. And of course, what also interested me was that also underlay it all, I suppose, is that Jones comes from the next village in South Wales to my husband, John Maddox. And I know the area, I have known industrial South Wales very well, in those small towns and people alike and types. And the picture of somebody from that background swanning around Austro-Hungary, telling them all what to do, as he did. And he wasn't Jewish, and they were, doesn't matter, as he said, there's a great affinity between the Welsh and the Jews, which he spotted. I don't think the Jews spotted it so much. And coming from that background and achieving what he did, it seemed to me, and you ask why I've written books about such different subjects, the answer is strictly I'm a journalist at heart. I like a good story. I like it when there's a question to be answered, when there's new material nobody else has looked at in this way, and I can put it all together and answer the questions that occur to me when I read about this life. And so, and then thanks to for my other biographies, I've had to go, I won't bore you with my adventures on the biographer's trail, but, you know, motels in Carbondale, Illinois, and Austin, Texas, and everything. Sherland Road is 10 minutes from my home in West. People say, where are the papers? I say, just up the road. And I have never had nicer working conditions or more helpful people. And so it has been a great pleasure. Find the Jones load up, and also the Jones family, his daughter Jackie Jones, his granddaughter is in Brighton, and his son, who many people say, oh, you're writing a biography of Mervyn Jones's father, which indeed I did, though while blind and disabled, his mind is very good, and he's in a very nice nursing home in Brighton, and I got a feeling also of his father from talking to him. I don't know whether that answers the question, but anyway, it all added up to a story I wanted to tell.
Had you read the Jones biography before you took him on as a subject?
Oh, yes, way before. Yeah. I mean, I'm old enough so that I actually bought it. You know, it was when you were getting great books in my first flat in America. I have the top shelf. I got through some great books thing, the three volumes of Freud by Jones. I didn't then think there's any two ways about it. It was all gospel. Mm. And now, as I read it now, after the other Peter Gay and other considered later biographies with much more material, I think it holds up very well. Sorry, thank you, Ernest, but I mean, I won't knock it the way people say, oh, it's hagiography and all that. It was a very good, solid job of work. And Jones did what any first biographer should do. He got the people while they were still alive. He talked to Anna Freud. He found out who was their music teacher when they were kids. I mean, there were a lot of people there still. So he gathered it quite methodically and got the information which nobody could now get about Freud's early life and his marriage and his children. And I think he put it together all in a very intelligent narrative. So if he idolized Freud and maybe gave himself too prominent a part in the story, I'm not sure he did, actually, but certainly many people are full of quibbles about the Jones biography. I think it holds up very well.
Well, in a way, you begin your biography with Jones entering Vienna in March 1938, and you end it with Antonia Burgess's account of that in his novel. And I suppose that was, I mean, that Jones did insert himself into the biography in that way and had to do. He was part of the biography.
Well, it is a bit risky doing that. I try, as a biographer, I tell you, I have one cardinal principle, which I broke, and that thing, is to follow chronology. One of my best editors I ever had, Roby McCauley at Houghton Mifflin in Boston, when I wrote Nora Joyce, a story, he said, don't anticipate. You know, we all read these biographies that say Berlioz did this and that, as he would find 20 years later when he went to Paris. And he said, don't do that. Don't always be jumping ahead for what you know is going to happen later. Keep the reader with you as the narrative unfolds. And so I do try to tell the story as we all live our lives. We don't know what's going to happen next. We know what's happening now. And I try to respect it from that point of view. But Jones, as he said, and I think he was a terrific writer, but and what I won't, his words are more elaborate than mine, but he said it's very difficult to achieve distinction if you share your surname with 500,000 of your contemporaries. I think he was right. I think he suffered all along from the Jones factor. Jones who? Everybody knows how many Joneses. And if he wanted to hyphenate his name and change it to Beto Jones, putting one of his other family names on it, and Freud said, no, you'll always be Ernest Jones to us. I'm not sure Freud's advice was right. I think he might have made more distinction when he wrote that three-volume biography if he had been by Ernest Beto Jones. He's hard to distinguish from the mass, but a question I ask myself often, I don't believe in what-if biographies. Oh, no. But I do say, about 1911, was it, or 1912, Jones was invited to Harvard. Anyway, all people were very impressed with his writings, not saying what Freud was saying. And they suggested perhaps he might teach at Harvard, have a chair at Harvard. And I ask you all, where would psychoanalysis in Britain be if Jones had stayed at Harvard? I don't think he wouldn't have founded this institute. He wouldn't have done the international work. He wouldn't have started the journal. He would have been a Harvard professor, which for many people is a lifetime satisfying occupation. I think it all could have gone that way. But Harvard and the good New England Puritan tradition, which maybe still lasts, once they found out that the Mrs. Jones traveling with Jones wasn't really Mrs. Jones, that they're not going to have things like that. So in a way, it was his loose life that actually saved him for Britain and to come over here and start the psychoanalytic tradition and bring everybody here and start all the journals and teach the straight cheese what was going on and all of that. But I do wonder what if.
I mean, we can come back to that. That opening of your biography with the flying in the monoplane from
Prague. He didn't fly it himself, though.
It almost feels like that. I mean, he had such a capacity for organizing things, didn't he? But the flying in with somebody else from Prague to Vienna, it strikes me as rather like a novel, the beginning of a novel, where one gets a picture and then the rest of the novel substantiates it, brings it to life.
Well, as I said, I really felt I don't like to do that. I don't think I do it in any of my other biographies, and I probably review badly other biographies which start that way. But as I said, nobody, Jones who?
Yeah.
And in that sense, by having that scene, which was true, it really happened, those were his words. And everybody's heard of Hitler and Vienna and the Anschluss and all that. It seemed to me that was a way of positioning him and showing his importance. And I couldn't resist it. And then maybe it was an arty touch when I got to the end to seeing the same scene had attracted Anthony Burgess. Mm. So he wrote a novel with the same scene of Jones flying in. And he made jokes about Jones's Welshness, or had Jones make jokes in German about his Welshness. And I thought that was funny.
Hmm. But I suppose it poses the question, and it's a question which analysts have in their mind, and biographers in the same way. How did this man, from this beginning, get to be in this position in 1938, from this small Welsh village? And that's the rest of the biography, I guess, isn't it?
Well, it is a good question. I mean, people, as my husband, editor from Nature for many years, it is possible to come from a small Welsh village and make your mark in London. But you have to try harder. And Jones he didn't get to Oxbridge. He had to make do with University College, and in Cardiff. It was really ambition, I think. And then, thank you for not mentioning it earlier, he did get into these scrapes earlier in his life, which actually blighted his career. He might have happily gone on and become a Harley Street neurologist with high fees and all the professional associations that would follow with that. And I think when he started out, when he came from Cardiff University to London for some more medical training, I think that was his highest ambition, was to rise in the London medical ladder. Well, if you read my book, or even if you haven't, you know he ran into a trouble with a scandal with some children at a school in Deptford. And school isn't there anymore. I spent all my time looking for it and found a school that looked just like it. And then that's horrible about biography. People say, no, that isn't the school. It was actually on the next street, and that's been torn down. And I had a perfect picture of the school, which I thought it all happened in. Anyway, he was accused of inappropriate, as Bill Clinton would say, behavior with some children. He was tried in court and acquitted. And of course, this happened 100 years ago, and we look at these things very differently now. And the doctors all rallied round, said, "We know, you know, we didn't do anything like that, and we're all vulnerable to that kind of charge." So I've just devoted chapter 4 to it. I don't know whether he was guilty or not. I think he probably was. But when he ran into something similar, with not quite so serious a charge, a few years later. In other words, his name was Mud in London, and he realized he was finished in London. He had to get out, so he had a very good offer to go to Toronto. So he went to Toronto, and we should all be glad because he wrote his finest work in Toronto. But really, psychoanalysis was the only route left to him after he stopped his career in neurology.
I mean, he got into trouble before that, didn't he? Was it 1903 for being absent without leave? And that seemed to blight his applications for
future jobs.
Well,
they say that. People have, actually maybe some of them are here, who make a career of reading the archives here and all of the hospitals he was at and the minutes of the meeting. And and I don't know if you'd done other doctors at the same time, what did you find on their records absent without leave? I don't know how serious a sin it was. Mm. But... again, I do think coming from Wales was no advantage, particularly at that time. And when he ran into, when he blotted his copybook, and they just suddenly just gave the jobs to somebody else. So he had to go to Canada. And then when he wanted to come back, he actually got into trouble in Canada too, ladies accusing him of the usual. And so he wanted to come back to London, and then psychoanalysis was the going thing.
One of them tried to shoot him.
Yes, yeah. So we're told, yes. Yeah. Anyway, yes. So he came back and made an attempt to marry Anna Freud. Freud wasn't very pleased about that. He said, you know, she's very innocent. And Freud by then was analyzing. Jones had sent his alleged false Mrs. Jones to Vienna to be analyzed by Freud, sort of, and the analysis was so successful she married another man named Jones. So then he was a free man, so then his eye, he liked to marry the boss's daughter, his eye fell on Freud's then pretty young daughter Anna, and Freud knew from analyzing Mrs. Jones, what Jones was like with the ladies, and Freud was appalled at the thought of his beautiful, innocent Anna in the hands of this roué. So he kind of steered him off. But then First World War I intervened, and Anna was sent back to...
Actually, he had Louis act as a sort of chaperone.
He did. He had Louis Kahn, his mistress, act as a kind of chaperone for Anna, and who liked her very much. Anyway, he didn't marry Anna Freud. He married some others. But they seemed to settle down, and he didn't seem to run into that trouble later, apart from the mysterious death of his first legal wife.
I mean, his reputation with women, which I think you deal with very well, hung on, didn't it? One of his nicknames was Erogenous Jones.
Oh, I didn't hear that. Yeah. I didn't know that. I would have put
I don't know quite. I think it probably came from the Strachey's.
Oh, yes.
Sounds Strachey-esque, doesn't it? But he was Erogenous Jones.
Well, of course they called him, they called him LB to the little beast.
Yes.
I mean, they were all tall Bloomsbury types, and, he didn't make jokes the way they did, and he was definitely not their class. They didn't invite him to their parties, which they made jokes about seamen and all this kind of Virginia Woolf joke. And it's a wonder that actually they collaborated so well, Jones and the Strachey's, because the Strachey's were ever, and I expect Jones too, conscious of the enormous class difference between them.
And it's amazing, Rickman and he, I mean, they had their fallouts, but they also collaborated extremely well institutionally within the society.
Yes, they did. You know, we'll know more about that than I did. I find the kind of organization and politics of the psychoanalysis as it got to World War II was almost beyond me, but I tried to get it right.
I think that's a book in itself.
Yeah, for somebody else, please.
Yeah. Rickman referred to him as the prophet of Allah.
Really?
For his autocratic behaviour.
Yeah.
But just going back to his attitude with women, I mean, one of the points in your book is that you feel that he somehow cures himself of it, or maybe it's through the relationship with Kitty that something settles.
Well, yes, I suppose he says he was analyzed with Ferenczi for 6 weeks or something. I think many people wish they could get away with that, and 6 weeks in Budapest. But he wasn't stupid. I think in that sense he did apply it to himself. Whatever he said to Freud, I'm always grateful to psychoanalysis for enabling me to conquer certain bad tendencies in myself.
Various somethings. Various difficulties.
I thought it was tendencies.
Is it tendencies?
Anyway, he chose this phrase, but I think he saw he was on the wrong track, and he, as a maybe even a good analyst, cured himself. Mm. And certainly, there's no question. I asked his son, Mervyn, didn't your father ever? No question, no other. Then his wife then helped him with the biography, and they worked together very happily for many years. So I couldn't find that he was even any of his patients writing accusing letters or anything after that. Mm. He seemed to settle down.
And he seems to have been very attached to his children too.
Yes.
But presumably that's part of the enigma of the man, that there is this early background of getting into awful trouble, which brought him to near professional ruin, and he manages by the end of your story of him to have made a very significant contribution.
Well, I think he did make it. I mean, in fact, I think he created this place. I don't know. I mean, think about what he'd think of the decor, but. He built it, and he built the journal, which isn't easy to do, an international journal, and referee the papers and make sure only the things, including a lot of his own, but things of high standard were published, and it really defined psychoanalysis. And I think Freud would actually have been lost without him. And Freud did thank him for, you've done everything possible for psychoanalysis, a journal, an institution, all this. And I do want, sincerely, this may be just my Welsh, pro-Welsh prejudice, think his extreme ordinariness of his name obscured his singularity of his achievements.
Uh-huh. What about his Welshness? I guess that's something you're very good on, I think.
Well, I should be.
But it becomes stronger in his later years.
It does for many people. I mean, but he did in his after his children grew up, and he had a daughter was learning Welsh, and he joined Plaid Cymru, bought a house on a tiny house. He spent a day there, a very tiny cottage in the Gower. In fact, I asked, how did they all live here with this little tiny one up, one down cottage with one big fireplace? And they said, and then the three children, the wife, he and the wife stayed at the pub. The children and the nanny lived in the cottage. Anyway, his roots did mean more to him as he went on, and he gave his children Welsh names. But he still, his country home was in Sussex, was it? Mm. Sorry. Mm. And so he didn't, obviously then you couldn't go there, Wales for the weekend. You had to go over there was no Severn Bridge then. It was the long way round. But he did go back quite a bit to his native land. Mm.
And he was responsible for establishing the Gower as a
Oh, yes, that was the first area of natural preservation. Yes, one of his least known achievements. I couldn't really...
well, I didn't know about it.
That's all right. I couldn't have started the book with that, but it is a very beautiful place. I think they're still voting for it on the television. I don't know how it's come out, if it hasn't been rigged in advance. But, yes, I suppose that's not unusual for people in their old age to become sentimental about their early years and the place of their early years. But... He did certainly stay loyal.
But I thought one of the things that you were maybe thinking in the book is that his Welshness has something to do. He's giving up his accent. He gets rid of his accent.
Yeah.
But he still hangs on to being Welsh in some way or other. And I thought it played a part in the way that you think about him as capable of what you call double allegiance.
Yeah.
Which you think of as not devious. But double allegiance.
Well, I mean, this gives my sociobiology view of the Welsh, but it's not like Scotland. It's not cut off by practically a fault line. You could cut the whole place off to see it. There's a long border, and Welsh history shows that people learn to accommodate with the people the other side of the border, and it's just, I think that is the tradition. And so he could swing both ways. And realized very early on that you had to. Just the Welsh establishment, certainly in medicine then, wasn't as strong as perhaps it is now in the university, so they had been started up. London was the place you were going to go. Mm-hmm. You had to go to make your reputation. But he went to all the Welsh knights and followed that in London. But it was also, I meant to say, he learned German. He was very fluent in German. I mean, he wasn't just a little provincial sobbing for the homeland. I think he made himself grow, I think, in a quite a remarkable way.
But some people took this double allegiance as deviousness.
Well, I say that, yes. Well, for you, I mean, they didn't realize, they didn't trace it to his Welshness, which I use other examples and know that this is an accusation often made. But Freud many times accused him of deviousness. But I must say, sitting here reading your excellent archives, to see the letters they wrote to each other, and they had these Rundbriefe, which they all wrote letters to each other saying what was happening in psychoanalysis. They wrote the round robin letter, and then they would each write private letters to each other telling them why they really didn't like this guy and why this guy was wrong, and they were all talking against him. I mean, they were all it was a very small group. And they all badmouthed each other in print. I mean, the printed record is every letter. You can find a letter by the same man written the same day, which says the very opposite to somebody else. I mean, Ferenczi and Freud and all that. I mean, it is really quite, quite depressing. And it does remind you what a very small world it was. And I also realized, I'm not a psychoanalyst, but in this small world, they each had their own theories, but they also depended on each other for patients. So they needed patients to get to. So if you send somebody to Freud, send somebody to Brill, and so they were grateful. So they didn't want you to know really that you had just said this about them to somebody else, because they were very grateful, and Freud particularly, for the patients. John sent him from London with the hard currency after the First World War. He was very, very glad to get Joan Revere and the street cheese and all those people and the currency. And they shared a bank in Holland, which was run by his mistress's family, Lo Kahn's bank. And so it was a very tight world. And I think that the true history of it and the interrelationships and the financial interrelationships really. Mm. Remain to be written about.
But I suppose, I mean, in terms of British psychoanalysis, then he had a double allegiance to Melanie Klein and Anna Freud.
Well, yes, I'm sure you've got your own versions of that story, but he brought Melanie Klein in at Joan Revere's suggestion. She was seen her work in Berlin and was very smitten, and Melanie Klein wanted to get out of Berlin to come to London, and Joan's brought her to London, and she just happened to be, his two small children just happened to be of the age to suit a Kleinian analysis. And she took his two children in, And in fact, I think you've got the little toys are all around here, which they played with and revealed their psyches. And he was very, very pleased. He said that she'd saved both of them, girl and a boy, from terrible neuroses. But then, of course, then when the war started to come, they had to got then Anna Freud and Melanie Klein really diverged on their views of child analysis and what age the Oedipus complex. Does anybody here, do you still debate that? What age does the Oedipus complex start? 1, 3, what? Anyway, it was a very big issue for them. And so Freud, Jones had to bring the Freuds over, really brought Melanie Klein's worst enemy, worst professional antagonist, to live within a few miles of her, or certainly to occupy with, and I believe the conflict simmers today, up in NW3. People seeing these things entirely differently, but I think Jones certainly had gone over, though he'd somehow managed, this is deviousness, he'd managed to keep his friendship with Freud intact, even though he'd supported Klein, and Freud didn't forgive him for supporting Klein against Anna. But I think he saw Jones's enormous usefulness to the psychoanalysis in the English-speaking world. So he was, and there was no way he was going to break with him entirely. And then, of course, events came in, and the whole Freud family came over, and Jones and Freud's son, who was here, got them settled in this lovely house in Hampstead, so well looked after by Michael. And they just had to, well, I don't know about, many people have written books about it, but anyway, they were just all stuck there. I mean, maybe the Freuds, if it hadn't been for Jones, maybe they should have gone to New York, and it would have been all entirely different. But here they were stuck together in the same small patch of London, and they did not agree. But he'd certainly pitched his allegiance to the Kleinian camp before the Freuds arrived.
Perhaps we should open it up and see whether there are any questions. Yeah.